Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karmateksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's talk, given by Lama Cathy Wesley, is entitled The Eightfold Noble Path, Part 2, Right View Produces Right Speech and Action. The Eightfold Noble Path is the how-to section of the Buddha's Four Noble Truths. It explains how a deeper view of the world and how our confusion about the world arises leads us to an entirely new perspective on how clinging and fixation shape our lives. This in turn teaches us to view ourselves and each other with new eyes of compassion. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karmateksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
So, good morning, everyone. Thanks for being here. Well, it's delightful to be here today to talk with you again. And this is going to be the second of two parts on the topic of the Eightfold Noble Path. As you know, recently I was asked to talk about it. And last time I gave my introduction to that, and then today I'm going to continue, and I'm working from this book, Kempo Carter Rinpoche's book, Dharma Paths. This book is a complete manual to the Buddhist path, in that it describes the life of the Buddha and what made the Buddha special. It explains what the Buddha's enlightenment is and what our potential for achieving enlightenment is. And it talks about how to apply ourselves to the methods of the teachings of the Buddha, which are called the Dharma, how to apply ourselves to the teachings of the Buddha in such a way that we ourselves accomplish awakening. And so that's why I decided to use this book, because it covers all the stages of the path. So that's why I picked this particular one. So before we get started, we'll start with a prayer, because it's really good to have a good intention when you're going to do something. And in the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, we start every program with some kind of intention, and the better the intention, the better the outcome. So we'll start with a short prayer. This one is the refuge prayer. We'll recite it one time in English. Okay. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Okay, thank you. I'm going to recite a short prayer of my own now. O Palin Sahwe Lama Rinpoche Dagi Chivo Pede Den Shela Kajan Chembo Kone Che Sunte Kusun Tuki Ngudrup Saldu So. Okay, thank you. So last time we spoke briefly about the Buddha and his awakening and his Four Noble Truths, the first of which was the truth that suffering is part of life. The second is that suffering has a cause, and that cause is clinging and fixation. And the solution is the third noble truth, which is to let go of clinging. And that the fourth of the Four Noble Truths is the path that leads to the end of clinging. And learning how to the practices of letting go. And so that is a brief summary of the Four Noble Truths. Suffering's part of life. It has a cause, which is clinging and fixation. It has a solution, which is learning how to let go of clinging and fixation. And the last is the path that shows us how. So in some ways, you could say that the teaching of the Buddha is in some ways very pragmatic. Not only did the Buddha describe the problem of being human and the difficulties we face as human beings, he showed us that we actually have within ourselves the power and capacity to take action on our problems. He didn't just say, here's a problem, good luck. He said, here's a problem, and here is what you can do with it. And so the teachings of the Four Noble Truths then are quite pragmatic. He said, the problem is that we are attached to me and I. All of us have some attachment to self or our self-concept. And as a result, we don't just have a mild attachment to the self. If we look at our daily activities, we might actually see that the majority of our activities of the day are related to the attempt to create happiness, well-being, safety, and security for ourselves and for those we hold dear. And so you could say that we spend our entire day practicing the first noble truth, the first two noble truths, suffering and its causes. And so as a result, the Buddha, by showing us this process, attempted to show us that we didn't have to suffer the way we do. And that's where the fourth of the Four Noble Truths comes in, the how. He didn't just say good luck. He said there is an Eightfold Noble Path. And I was just talking to Winnie during the break here, and she let me know that last week Kathy Jackson and company did a fabulous job of fleshing out the Eightfold Noble Path. And so this is really good. So we can take that lecture as part of this one and say that that what was taught last time regarding the Eightfold Noble Path is a stepping stone and a help to the what we're going to talk about today. So what we talked about during the first week of talks on this was that the Eightfold Noble Path is both the path and the goal. I know that sounds a little strange, because isn't the path supposed to lead to a goal that is somehow different from the path? Aren't we going from A to B? And isn't A not B? And isn't B not A? So it may sound a little confusing to say that the Eightfold Noble Path are both path and goal. But the reason for this is because the Buddha taught not just a philosophy, he taught a practice. He taught a practice that we can do right now. We don't have to wait until we're more knowledgeable. We don't have to wait until we get a sign from the universe that it's time for us to practice. We can actually start practicing now. If you look at the Eightfold Noble Path, it begins with our intentionality. It goes with right view. It talks about right thought. It talks about speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right meditation, and wisdom. And so in this way, the path does lead from A to B, and yet we are different from what we were when we began it. So Kemp Rinpoche, in his book Dharma Path, says that on page 227 of his book, which you can refer to when you're listening to this talk, he says that we start out with a lot of confusion, and we need to be unconfused, which is why right view and right thought are so important. If we believed, for example, that self-fixation and trying to get happiness for ourselves alone was the ultimate, then we would be spending all our time doing that. But the fact of the matter is, the Buddha said that many of the things we try to do to bring happiness to ourselves actually bring us suffering because of the clinging. Any person who's ever had a friendship go wrong knows how this works. Sometimes one person defines the relationship one way, and the other person defines the relationship another way, and eventually they are not in sync. And so then there are expectations on both sides, and then negative things start to happen as people increasingly misunderstand one another. And so as a result, our wish to have friends and to have relationships in order to bring happiness, safety, and security to our lives, it doesn't succeed. It ultimately doesn't succeed because of our grasping to our ideas of how things should be. And so by teaching us the Four Noble Truths, suffering, its cause, its solution, and the path, the Buddha gave us the right view. But now we have to practice it. And so how do we practice right view? We practice right view by having right thought. But how does that work exactly? Well, when you look at the Buddha's teaching, he said, do no harm, practice virtue, and tame your mind. Taming the mind is how we come about right thought. We do our best to not harm ourselves. We do our best not to harm others. And then we tame our minds through the practice of meditation. And when we meditate, anybody who's ever meditated knows how it works. You're sitting in meditation and you're attempting to do just one thing in meditation, because the path of meditation is to do one thing. And usually it's watching the breath. Or perhaps it could be reciting a mantra. Perhaps it could be meditating on compassion and love. But whatever it is that is our chosen topic, if what we get when we place our attention on that topic is we get a short period of attention that is then followed by a period of mental wandering. We either wander into what happened yesterday, which may be good or bad, depending on that day, or we wander into the future, what might happen tomorrow or the next day, which again could be good or bad, depending on how we are. But we're not present in the present moment. We're no longer there. And so the teaching of the Buddha then is when we notice that our attention has wandered, we gently bring it back to our breath or the object of meditation for a fresh start. And what we get when we do that is we begin to notice our thoughts, both when we're meditating and when we're not meditating. And has anybody noticed this? When we're not meditating, we suddenly become aware of our thoughts. People come to me after they've been meditating for a while and they say, well, I don't know if I'm doing it right. And I say, well, why is that? Well, I have a lot of thoughts. And the answer is, yes, you're doing it right. Because now these are thoughts that you didn't notice before. It's not that you're having more of them, it's just that they are more, you're seeing them more clearly. And so the teaching of the Buddha about this is to keep letting go of those thoughts and keep returning your attention to the breath for a fresh start. Just keep doing it over and over and over again with a sense of gentleness. You're basically parenting the child of your Buddha mind when you do this with a gentility and goodness. You're parenting the child of your Buddha mind gradually and slowly, teaching them how to have right thought. And you can feel this, because when you're not having right thought, there's a lot of tension in your body. Your physical body actually gets tense. Think about it this way. Maybe you've had a quarrel with someone, and you're out of the room and they're not in the room. And suddenly they walk in the room, this person that you had a quarrel with, and then suddenly the hairs on the back of your neck start to stand up and you get this kind of like feeling. You have now experienced wrong thought. The thought that emphasizes self-fixation, the thought that emphasizes it's them, it's that person I quarreled with. And then gradually what happens is that then wrong words start to come out of our mouths. It just, we may try to hold them back, but that wrong thinking has given birth to wrong speech. And now we're kind of in a pickle, because we went into that room with great intentions and then they walked in, that person we have quarreled with. And so then, because of that, everything kind of gets murky and confusing. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, in one of his books, described why this happens. He said, when we quarrel with someone or have some kind of dispute with someone, for a moment, we forget who we are. We forget. We have an, he says, he calls it an identity crisis. We have an identity crisis when we get upset about something or get angry with someone. We have an identity crisis. We actually think that they who are who we think they are, an enemy. And we think that we are who we think we are, which is the good person. Okay? So because we have made these definitions in our minds, we try to make everything in reality fit that. And I don't know if any of you have experienced this, but I sure have, and it does not feel good. And so the difference here between right action and right view, right thought, and right speech is that speech, thought, and view influenced by self-fixation? Is it coming from our self-fixated place? Or is it coming from the part of us that is more open to the idea of both us and them having Buddha nature? Are we more open to the fact that they are a Buddha in training as well? And that our job is to help facilitate that training. Now, that doesn't mean that we're gentle with people who have wronged us. It means that we are firm with people who have wronged us, but in a way that allows them the opportunity to change. I know that's easier said than done. But from the philosophical viewpoint of Buddhism, having a softer view of that person we've quarreled with, having a softer view of them as being a person who's not in control. The only reason they've acted out is because they're not in control of their minds. They're out of their minds. They're out of control of their minds. And then this doesn't mean we will allow them to speak abusively or act abusively toward us. But what it does mean is that our job is not to overthrow them and punish them. That's not our job. Our job is to actually facilitate understanding and to facilitate their discovery of their own heart of wisdom and compassion. Because that's kind of what we're trying to do with our own Buddha mind. We're trying to uncover our own heart of wisdom and our own heart of compassion. So you could say that having right view means to have a view that doesn't hold on to grudges. Having right view is the mind that thinks of benefiting others rather than harming them. And so right view then would lead to right thinking, which can be fixed on the spot, by the way. We may think that, I talked to someone yesterday who said that they were having a problem with their thoughts, and could I help? I think it's the outfit. People look at the Lama dress and they think, oh, maybe she knows something. The answer is no, but I have great clothes. But this person said that they tended to have a bad feeling about themselves. Their thinking about themselves was not right thinking. They actually had the thought that they were bad people because they goofed up a lot in their life. Oh, I made so many mistakes in my life. I'm a goof up. And I said, well, you know, in the teachings of the Buddha, they talk about, I talked about this during the first lecture too, bak chak. It's two words in Tibetan, B-A-K-C-H-A-K. And what it means in English is habitual tendency. So we all have habits of thinking and viewpoint and speech, and we all have habits. And right now, most of the habits are self-influenced, selfish and self-influenced. So now what we have to do is we have to first trade the selfish ones for the less selfish ones, slightly less selfish. And then eventually we'll go to the most selfless ones. But we're just, it's a journey. We're on our way. It's baby steps. So correct viewpoint then is that everybody's struggling and everybody's suffering. Correct thought is, how can I help this person and myself? Correct speech is that speech which serves the benefit of self and other. So you can see that from view springs thought, and from thought springs speech, and from speech springs action. And so this is how the first of the first four of the Eightfold Noble Path influence and help each other. They're not just an idea, they're a path. So in order to practice the first four, meditation is extremely helpful. So I recommend to everyone who wants to practice the Eightfold Noble Path that even though right meditation is at the end, that you start doing it right now anyhow. Don't wait. Because what meditation does is it gives you that view into what your thoughts are. And then you can, through right view and thought, you can begin to change them. Because at first, you'll see your negative thoughts and speech and actions coming, and it'll be like you're trying to avoid a collision that is inevitable. Oh no, oh no. And then eventually we collide with another person and there's conflict. At first, when we see those negative thoughts coming, we won't be able to stop them and it'll feel a little bit helpless. But what will happen is that gradually we will be able to slow them down just a little bit. It starts with slowing them down. And then once we slow down, then the impact may be in slow motion. So that when we actually collide, it won't be quite as bad. And so that's why meditation is useful, even if we're not quite good. So what do we do for people like my friend who said that she's a goof up and that she can't stop thinking she's a goof up and that's her habitual tendency? I suggested that when she has those thoughts, that she has a conversation with them, the thoughts. She can ask the thought, well, hello, who are you and where did you come from? Rather than believing every thought that arises in a person's head, they could actually ask themselves questions about it. There's a lovely book called It's Up to You about the practice of self-reflection in Buddhism. And this practice is a real thing, and it's a way to practice the first of the Eightfold Noble Path by self-examination and questioning of the thoughts we have every day over and over again. We have to ask, where did you come from, thought that I am a goof up? What good are you doing me right now, thought that I am a goof up? What type of feeling do I feel when I think you, thought that I am a goof up? Has that been useful for me? And can I do something different in this moment? And when I was here the last time, I shared the self-examination that one of my Dharma friends gave me, where she examined her thoughts like this. And at the end, she was able to say, thank you, thought from the past. Thank you for trying to protect me, but I'm okay now. I don't need you anymore. And a lot of these habitual thoughts come back again and again because they're familiar, like a warm blanket. They're familiar and you feel like they're part of you. But they're actually just a thought that you've had so many times that you think it's part of you. This woman really believed she was a goof up because of what she was thinking every day and every day. And so I said to her, if you try this every time you have that thought, instead of letting that thought think you, if you back up just a little bit, just step outside the thought for one moment. That takes a lot of doing. We have to actually recognize that we're having a habitual pattern. And at first that's not easy. And sometimes you won't know it until the next day, but that's okay because at least you figured it out. But then stepping outside that thought for just a moment and saying, oh, thought, where did you come from? What is your purpose? And other questions of that type, and just kind of examining the thought, and it's at the end saying, well, thank you so much for trying to protect me, but I don't need you anymore. And then placing our attention on something more healthy for ourselves, which is that I just changed that thought. I just had a success. I am not a goof up because I actually changed my thought. And so gradually I can change all of my thoughts. So these first four of the Eightfold Noble Path have to do with changing how we think, and meditation is central to that process. And then, meanwhile, while we're doing that, we're learning about what right action, speech, and thought are. Anybody who's familiar with the Buddha's teachings on right speech and right action and so forth will refer to his teaching on the 10 virtuous actions and the 10 non-virtuous actions. The 10 non-virtuous actions, there are 3 of body, 4 of speech, and 3 of mind. I think it's very ironic. As a person who loves to talk, I think it's very ironic that 4 of them have to do with speech, only 3 for the body and 3 for the mind, but 4 with speech. What's up with what we do? I guess it's because humans are very good or bad at talking. The first of the negative actions or unwholesome actions of body is killing. Taking the life of another being with intention and with satisfaction. The opposite of that is the first of the virtuous actions, which is instead of killing, saving lives. Yes, even removing that spider from the corner and putting it outside is saving lives. Maybe a tiny life, but it's a life. The opposite of killing is saving lives. The second physical negative action is stealing. So that basically means taking that which has not been given to us. And it causes a lot of negativity in that it deprives other people of resources and it gives us the illusion that we have them. But of course, because anything that is done with a negative connotation brings an outsized result. It is said that the outsized result of having been an unrepentant killer is that our own life is shorter. It is the way karma, the karma of our body, speech, and mind works. And the outcome of stealing is that we will have fewer resources. Whereas if we practice the second of the virtuous actions and give generously, that's the opposite of stealing, is being generous with our resources, giving to others. And if we do that, then we provide ourselves with resources in the future. The third of the negative actions of body is sexual misconduct. This causes us to have negative relationships. And whereas if we keep a pure moral discipline, then what this means is that we will have better relationships. It seems to match. But what about those 4 of speech, those 4 negative actions of speech? One is lying, and the opposite of that is to be truthful. The second is harsh speech, and the second of the virtuous speech is gentle, soft speech. The third of the negative speeches is divisive speech, which is where we divide others through saying negative things. And the opposite of that is to patch up quarrels and to speak to bring others together. And the fourth of the negative kinds of speech is my personal favorite, meaningless chatter. which actually includes gossip and any other of the meaningless chatter that we can engage in an everyday context. And the fourth of the positive aspects of speech is to speak meaningfully about important things. And lastly, the three negative actions of the mind. The first is a jealousy, wanting what others have. I'm sorry, being jealous of what others have. And then the opposite of that is rejoicing in what others have. The next one is covetousness, where you want what others have. And the other is the opposite of that is, again, to rejoice. And finally, the last one is ill will. Ill will, holding ill will against somebody for some reason. And I got that wrong. Covetousness and jealousy are the same. Then ill will, but the last one, the one I mixed up and forgot, was the I had it a second ago. Ill will. Oh, wrong view. So it's jealousy and covetousness, ill will and wrong view. Wrong view means that you hold the ideas such as things I say and do don't matter. Karma isn't real. It's just a scam, and nothing I do is going to cause any problem for anybody. So as you can see, these negative things can bring about the strengthening of our self-fixation, and the positive things, whether they're rejoicing in what others have, learning the Dharma and holding right view, or bringing about a sense of goodwill as opposed to ill will. If we do the opposites, then we change our bok-chok, our habitual tendencies, from selfish ones to less selfish ones. And so I think I'm going to stop there for now, because we talked about the first four of the Eightfold Noble Path. And by holding right view, seeing the interconnectedness of all things, and the fact that our thoughts, words, and actions make a difference and change us, from there we can gradually, through training, take on the right thoughts by not doing the negative actions and doing the positive ones of our body, speech, and mind. And then through right view and right thought, then right action and speech evolve from that. And then next time we get together, we will talk about right livelihood, right effort, wisdom, and meditation. So we'll talk about that the next time. So I figured that this would be a good start. But again, as I said the last time, what's really important is not just learning the four of this and the eight of that and the ten of this. That's not really the key piece. The key piece is to practice. Because without practice, the lists are just bunches of words that really don't have any meaning until we apply them to ourselves. And so that's my hope, is that everyone will take the words and use them as incentive to go home and practice meditation and see what kind of habitual tendency you're making, and then how to counteract those negative tendencies through your practice. So in any case, I think it's time to have a discussion. We had a good one last time. And I heard that the discussion last week was a good one too. So if anybody has thoughts, questions, ideas, comments, their own observations about how thoughts lead to words and actions, you can get in line. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. I was reading a pop psychology book about four steps for handling thoughts, where what it advised was that if you had a drifting thought, that you should that you should first relabel it as being a product of your brain chemistry, then pretty much ruminate on it for the second step, and then the third step, refocus by doing another task or doing something that's actually helpful. And then a fourth one, I think it was just move on with your life with it after that. But it was recommending that if you had an impulsive thought, you should wait 15 minutes after the impulse before acting, because the brain activity that caused it would have subsided by the 15 minutes. Is that considered right view?
Wow. You know, I'll tell you what, it's obviously, because as you say, it's a psychology book. You know what I'm saying? It's because it's a psychology book, I can't say that it's a Buddhist teaching, but it sounds really interesting. It sounds like the methodology is solid from a contemplative point of view. I can't say it's Buddhist particularly, but if you think about it, all of that really does seem to fit, because what waiting, which is that first step, is waiting, right? You wait 15 minutes before you have an impulse, before you act on it. And during the 15 minutes, you do these four steps.
First,
you know,
two is recognizing the impulse. The first two is recognizing the impulse. Yeah, the third one's refocusing on something.
Yeah.
You recommended meditation if you had nothing else to do.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I can't say that that is specifically a Buddhist teaching, but I'll tell you what, it sounds like a really pragmatic way to step outside. You see what I'm saying? Because what the lady I was talking to yesterday, when she was saying, I'm a goof up, and that's her thought, and she always has this thought, and I just basically said, well, what if you stepped outside that thought, which is exactly what the first parts of that process are telling you, aren't they? It's telling you to telling you not to act, and while you're not acting, instead, you can look at the thought as being the product of chemistry. Then you can actually do something different and refocus your attention someplace else, which I just think is lovely, because it gives power to the individual so that they can actually make a change. That's cool.
Okay.
Thanks for sharing that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have to bring this down. Because
yeah, I think
sure.
It's interesting how many modern psychology books, and I think it's really interesting how many modern psychology books are actually kind of Buddhist. They're sort of Buddhist, you know. So, yeah.
Hello.
Yes.
Have to bring this down a little bit because I'm a bit short, but
we're all different. Yeah, I get it.
So, what I've noticed, or one of the observations that I've had since I've been coming here is, with right speech and right view and right action, is to stop focusing so much on ourselves and what we want and what we need, and mostly focus on what's good for everyone. And when we focus on that, ultimately it comes back to us. That's what I'm getting from your teaching.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think just like the first questioner, I think that what's really great about meditators is that once they start meditating and they understand what right view is, and they understand that, they can see Dharma even in so-called worldly psychology books. I mean, it's all Dharma, because it's all getting us to step back from instantly identifying with the thought. And it leads us to more contemplative ways of being. And that does, I think, in many ways lead to more satisfaction in our lives, because we can see how our frenzied thinking has made us go wrong so many times, and how changing that even just a little bit can make a big difference. And I think that your experience of noticing your thoughts and trying to change them into being kinder and to being thinking of others, this is part of that progression from right view to right thought to right speech and right action. You see what I'm saying? It's like it does sort of follow. And at first it seems a little fake, I have to say, because people say that to me. They say, well, you know, this is kind of fake. And it's like, well, Let's put it this way. It's actually closer to who we really are anyway, because if you look at the teachings on Buddha nature, the Buddha said that all of us have Buddha nature. And as a result of all of us having Buddha nature, we are, that, you know, kindness and goodness is actually more of our birthright. And so, yeah.
I like that. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks.
So I actually...
Yeah, I know. Adjustment.
Different size, that's fine. pardon me. I actually just had one comment and then a question. So kind of continuing off of what he was saying, how in a lot of psychology books these days, they're almost leaning more towards Buddhism in the sense that they're bringing up meditation a lot more.
Right.
I've noticed that a lot more in like health and wellness and like a lot of fitness mm-hmm. things that you see yeah. Online or books or whatever. I can't tell you how many fitness regimens I've found online that include meditation. They tell you to meditate on top of your, lifting, running, whatever you choose
right.
to do.
Mm-hmm.
Cause I think more and more people are recognizing the correlation between the mind and the body.
Mm-hmm.
But then the question part of this was, something that I've observed in my own personal practice is when I'm at home, when I meditate at home, I don't meditate for quite as long as I do here. I'll do like 15 minutes, but, and usually only, after work. But I notice that when I'm at home and I do what I think I'm supposed to be doing. I like, lower the light.
Sorry, this one's
it's
me.
lower the lights. Like I'll use like a guided meditation. I'll put mm-hmm. on some incense, like everything I think I'm supposed to be doing, but I find myself being a lot more distracted and fidgety
mm-hmm.
at home.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I'm here meditating for longer here than I do at home,
mm-hmm.
I'm somehow a lot mm-hmm. more, focused, I guess.
Sure.
And less eager to like wrap it up.
Yeah. Got it.
And well, like when you get home,
I hear
work,
that.
Like just everywhere, like I have like a million things that, you know, so sometimes when I'm sitting there meditating, I'm thinking like,
mm-hmm.
I really should be doing the dishes or like, got to do this, that or the other. Whereas when I'm here, even though, I mean, it's Sunday, we all have stuff to do. I feel like I'm a lot more, present. And
yeah.
And I don't know if it's like, because it's a group meditation versus being at home alone. I don't know. I'm just wondering your thoughts on that.
Yeah. First of all, the reason that people chuckled when you know, they laughed a little bit is because what you're saying is absolutely 100% true, which is that it does seem to be the case when we are in our familiar home environment, that the home environment, one of the... there's like, there's good and not so good in the home environment. The good in the home environment is that it is familiar and comfortable for the most part. But the not so good part about that is that the dishes are speaking to you from the kitchen. Come and wash me, you know, and like, and even the room you're sitting and meditating in, often it will be calling for your attention, you know, and this is why I think it is easier for many people to meditate in a neutral environment like the meditation center, because they know they don't have those visual prompts of, you know, the prompts of seeing something that one thinks needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's part of the reason for it. And I also think that what you say is true, that it actually has been mentioned to me by other people that they do tend to meditate a little longer and a little better when they're with a group, because they feel the shared motivation of the group. And this is true of exercise also, that people who tend to do exercise or yoga or a Tai Chi in a group seem to feel more satisfaction than those who do it alone.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's because the group does actually push us a little bit. And so what you can take from this is that in your home environment, one of the things you can do is you can reduce the inputs of these prompts of things that you feel need doing. Mm. And His Eminence, Taisitu Rinpoche, said, it's really hard for us sometimes to recognize, but really, we're in charge of our own minds. He says, I know it feels a lot like other people, your responsibilities to other people and this, that, that you think you're not in control of your time and mm-hmm. you're not in control of your mind. So why don't you start your meditation by taking back some of that power that you've given to all your responsibilities? Take back some of that. When you first sit down, tell yourself, okay, I'm just going to sit here as long as I want. I have all day. Mm-hmm. I have all the time in the world, and I have all the space in the world. And he says, even if it's not 100% true,
yeah, it never is.
he said, try to foster. It's fostering something means it is a little artificial, but at mm-hmm. least you're trying to do something. He said, foster the notion of expansiveness and ease, and then apply yourself to your practice, which will begin with some type of prayer like the one we started our talk with today, mm-hmm. and with intentionality that I'm going to sit here and practice meditation for the next few minutes and try to remain with the technique and stay with the technique for the benefit of myself and others. Mm-hmm. And then at the conclusion, you dedicate the goodness of the practice session to the benefit of yourself and others. And that kind of embraces it with this expansive viewpoint. But yeah, but the other thing to take from what you've said is that we have to give ourselves some physical and mental space when we sit down, no matter where we're sitting down, whether we're sitting in the group or at home. Mm. And so I think being able to use little techniques like this idea of sitting down with this intention and expansiveness is good.
Yeah.
But just keep coming back to the group and keep coming back and consider, think about the possibility of doing a one-day retreat sometime.
Mm, okay.
Whether you do it at home or do it with us, you know, we're going to try to provide those opportunities from time to time. Our circumstances are a bit limited here, but I was talking to another one of my Dharma friends today, and I said, even if you just say, I'm going to take one Saturday morning and do extra practice and pretend I'm in a Dharma retreat for like 2 or 3 hours, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can also be kind of a good thing. But yeah. And if you have friends, you can do it with your friends. So.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate
that. Thank you. Uh-huh.
Good morning.
Good morning. Hi. Yeah, I know. Yeah. All shapes and sizes.
Oh, this is good. So during your teaching, I was reminded or started thinking about a line that you've said before many times at the beginning of the Dhammapada, that we are what we think.
Yeah.
And just how thankful I am for this, because to me, what we're talking about in the Eightfold, is it Eightfold or Ten?
Eightfold Noble Path.
Oh, and then Ten on Virtues. Okay. Eightfold Noble Path.
I know, it confuses me too. That's why I got them wrong.
Yeah. Is I'm thinking about, if we are what we think, then this training in improving, I don't know if that's the right word, or pure... Mm-hmm. cleaning up what we think, mm-hmm. then it's also cleansing or helping make possible who we are.
Right.
Which is a better experience, more peaceful, just, yeah. So, 'cause I'm thinking about, you know, there's a lot out there that encourages, for example, divisive speech.
Like, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That's kind of like the thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then that's who we are.
Right.
You know, so having this alternate set of mm-hmm. ways to structure your habits. Mm-hmm. And develop like new habits is just really great. And the other thing I thought that I guess is kind of related is that we should be patient. Like your different people you've mentioned who are really self-critical should be patient with themselves, because I think there can be a lot of momentum behind past habits.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
that's right.
You know, even cultural centuries of habits, mm-hmm. you know, and so mm-hmm. turning that around, you know, not that we should be lazy and not work at it, but we can be patient about turning that momentum in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks for the great teaching.
Yeah, no, thank you for your observations, because those observations, I really appreciate what you've had to say, because it crystallizes a lot of what we've been talking about, which is that how we think about things influences how we experience the world. And so the fact that your reflection on this has shown you the truth of it, and how your own experience of it has shown you the truth of it. And I think that this is very similar to what some of the other folks have come to when they've come to the microphone, is that because of their applications of these techniques, they've been able to see the Dharma present in all sorts of areas, whether it's in psychology or in health and well-being and fitness, and all of these different ways that we actually see Dharma reflected in our society. And I think that we're actually, this is why I tend to think that even though some folks are kind of depressed because of how things are going in the world, I kind of feel like all of us who are determined to do something different, we actually do have power to do something different. The people, we're committed to it. A lot of people, you know, these days in politics, they talk about resistance, you know, this type of thing. But really, in a way, what we really have to resist is not one political entity or party, but we have to resist our own impulse to dislike and to hate, and we have to resist our own impulses to judge and to punish, and we have to resist our own impulses to basically try to overpower other people. And so, in a way, we have to, that's what the real resistance is about resisting our lack of love. His Holiness Karmapa said, you know, a lot of people come to me and they say, oh, the world is in a terrible mess right now. What do you think we should do? And he said, yes, if you look, you know, the environment is falling apart and people are doing all kinds of bad things and there's war and so forth. And he says, I think it all comes down to lack of love. We have a shortage of love in this world. And so anything we can do to turn that around is going to be to the good. So I appreciate you taking those things to heart and showing us kind of how they have been part of your experience. Because I think that's, even if we just make that 1% improvement, I think you've heard me quote His Eminence Thich Nhat Hanh Trungpa many times, where he said, if I improve 1% in this lifetime, 100 lifetimes, I'll be Buddha. You know, so that, I mean, and I love it that you mentioned the fact that that people can get the idea that they are changeable and that their minds are workable. They are changeable and their minds are workable, and that should give them some momentum in the positive, and that they can try to think of their life as a journey forward, not as a struggle against something, but as an actualization of something that is good within them. See, because that's the thing about Buddhism. The Buddha taught everybody has Buddha nature. Everybody has a mind that can wake up. And the fact that all of these different parts of the world are trying to wake up in one way or another and take control of the mind in one way or the other, it's just fantastic. It's just, I mean, because that's, I think, where the good stuff is going to come from, is when more people hook into that. Somebody asked Kempo Karthar Rinpoche, well, what do you think about this mindfulness revolution, you know, where people are talking about mindfulness and it's divorced from the teachings of Buddhism? Is that okay? Or is that not good? And he said, I love it. I love it. He said, because human beings, when they sit and meditate, he said, something actually happens in their minds. And then he said they have confidence, and they have confidence that there's something more than what they have put all of their faith in up to now. And he said, now then they want to go looking. Well, where did this meditation come from? And who taught it? And like, what's going on? Is there more? And the answer is, yes, there's more. And it's in this little book, you know, Dharma Paths, you know, so it's like that. So thank you. We have, yes, this will be our last one today.
Sorry, I'll make it quick.
No problem.
So I wanted to ask for a clarification on what you mean by meaningless chatter, because I was reading, I think it's called The Lost Art of Good Conversation. I'm forgetting the author, but he said that something like small talk was an act of compassion towards the other, right? Even though it's not, you know, divining the answers of the universe, you're putting another human being at ease, right? So we can see how destructive gossip is, but what exactly is meaningless chatter?
I really get what you're saying, and I think that what you're saying is very true, because sometimes a good conversation is an act of generosity. So I'm totally signed on with that, because all of us have family members who are not Buddhist, right? And so, okay, so I had a beloved auntie, and I loved her so much, but she would just kind of, you know, you pull the string and she just go, you know, and you know, and she would just, I mean, go and go and go, and she would say things like, well, I don't really know what you believe, but I think it's really great that you have a religion, and blah, 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 and then, you know, and it just kind of like, okay, honey, I love you, and I would just sit and listen to her, and every now and then I try to break in and say something useful, but, you know, but she was just going, and I don't necessarily think of that as meaningless chatter exactly, unless it's meaningless when it self-aggrandizes. Because, you know, people will come and they talk about, you know, themselves a lot. And so I would say that meaningless chatter is not this kind of generosity conversation, which we would have. Let's for example, I visited my dad's wife frequently in the nursing home. And you know what we would do? We would just talk. And I would play cards with her. And we would joke around and so forth. And from some definition, that might be meaningless, but it comes back to your motivation. And in the earliest teachings of the Buddha, they talked about right view and that it precedes everything else. And in the second set of teachings, the Mahayana teachings, it talked about this intention of, and they said in the first one, your actions were very important in the first set of teachings. In the second, it's your intention was actually more important than the actual action. So I would say, don't worry too much about those generous conversations. That's all good, because they're mainly talking about gossip, and they're mainly talking about the kind of thing where people just aggrandize themselves, you know, and that kind of meaningless thing. You know, so it's, yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. There are so many other examples I could think of, but most of them really come down to that, you know, and like, oh, what's so-and-so going to do? You know, okay. This week people have been saying, what do you really think about the royal family in England? And I'm like, and it's like, the royal family in England, that's all real interesting, but you know what I'm saying? So, but those generous conversations, even if it is about the royal family, it's all good, because, you know, you're putting somebody at ease. And I think that's really important. So, thank you for your thoughts and sharing your experience, and for coming and meditating here. Let's do it again next week. And next time I talk, I'll be talking about the second, the last set, which is right livelihood, right effort, right meditation and wisdom. So we'll be talking about that the next time. And so in the meantime, watch your mind this week and see how it goes, and try to see what kinds of habitual tendencies you're creating for yourself with your thoughts, and what viewpoints you could take that might be different. So we'll think like that. Let's sit quietly for just a moment, and mentally dedicate the goodness of our session. We mentally dedicate the goodness of this session to all suffering beings. May all beings be free of suffering, come to happiness, and then to awakening. And coming to awakening, may they emanate in all directions and benefit sentient beings endlessly. We mentally dedicate our goodness with this thought in mind. Okay, thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.